You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club. I am your mild-mannered host, Matthew Rushing. And with me, well, they're not always here, but I feel like they're always here in spirit. It feels like it's been a long time since I've had both of these guests on the same show, and I'm feeling rather giddy. I feel like I could fly right now, and so I'm really glad to have both of these guys. One, the amazing Bruce Gibson.
Hello, hello. Yay! I'm getting a golf clap from the other guy that you're going to introduce here. Hey, you know what? What's funny is, well, you haven't talked about what you're going to talk about, so I'll hold off.
Yeah.
Well,
don't give it away, Bruce.
Then allow me to introduce the dulcet-toned John Mills.
Well, I am bald, which is a very important... Oh, thank you. Thank you. Is a very important aspect if you're going to have a supervillain on a show. So... You know.
Well, it's true, and yes. I noticed that you decided not to go with one of your fabulous wigs tonight. So,
well, they're all at the cleaners, unfortunately, but they'll be
Mrs.
back next
Tess
week.
Mrs. Tessmacher!
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
See, what I was going to say is I just came from a holiday party at our office, and I just realized I've got a blue shirt on, and then I've got a red sweater over it. I feel very much like Clark from Smallville, always having to wear red and blue in some kind of combination.
Yeah. Ooh, coordinated. I like that.
Was it a hula theme, you know, like kind of like we get with Lex and his band of buffoons?
No, but it was a casino writer. Theme.
Ooh,
oh, very nice.
Like Canto Bight.
Yes.
Mm. With, you know, less running, you know, cow donkey things.
Yes, so. Cow donkey.
Well, there were some asses there.
there were some jackasses in
the
party. Tip
your waiters, everybody.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're in for a great show tonight. If you don't realize what we're going to be talking about, we're going to go all the way back to the original Superman film, Superman the Movie, that came out in 1978, directed by Richard Donner. The one that actually, I would say, kind of kicked off what we think of as a Hollywood franchise superhero movie in a way that nobody had ever seen before. So we are going to talk through that. And luckily, and you're not going to believe me, but I legitimately, when I planned this, had no thought that it was the 40th anniversary as we're recording this in just a couple of days. It was just my thought, hey, that might be kind of fun to talk about that before we get to Aquaman. Well, fortuitously, it is the 40th anniversary, so we're going to celebrate that together. Before we dive into the film, just make sure you check us out all over the place. You can find the 602 Club everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're over on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and all that stuff, give us a star rating review. Help people find the show. It really does. And it's been a long time since we've gotten a new star rating review. And I love reading those reviews out in the show. And so do that. Again, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. The biggest thing, too, wherever you are getting the 602 Club, make sure you're subscribed. That way, as soon as I drop the show, you get it. You can find us on Twitter at TrekFM. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM, where you can check out everything that we're doing. We get all the shows posted there. If you want to get more in depth with the fans of the Trek FM network and talk about the shows, talk about everything that we're talking about here on Trek FM, you'll want to go to the Babel Conference, which is our listeners-only discussion group. That is on Facebook as well. Now, to get there, maybe you're on Facebook. Type Babel into the search field, the Babel Conference, or go over to the website at trek.fm. Any of the show pages that you check out, you'll see a little button there. It says discussion. Hit that, it'll bring you over to the group. And maybe you would like to send us an email. Love getting emails on the show, what you think, maybe ideas you might have for the upcoming new year. As we're recording this, we're right before the end of 2018 into 2019. So go over to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that'll come to me. Any of the hosts that were on with me that week, and we can talk to you about whatever it is that you thought was interesting. Now, guys, we're all similar aged in the sense that, you know, this is a movie that we all grew up with. And so I wanted to ask you what your first flight was. What was the first time that you saw this movie? And I kind of wanted to know just what was the impact that it had on you at that age?
I don't remember the exact age, but I know that it was VHS. And I saw it in short order before seeing Superman 2 on VHS. And so the two are sort of inextricably linked. But basically that's my first memory. The strongest memory I have of it are two things. One is being absolutely enraptured with the title sequence. Just, it was the coolest thing seeing the letters come out. Like I was like, wow, this is so cool. And, you know, just loving it overall and everything. And also one time when my two older cousins, my brother and myself, snuck away to watch it. Long story short, we were where we were not supposed to be, and one of my older cousins got a migraine while watching it, and we had to call for help, and got all busted for not being where we were supposed to be. So those are my two primary memories of seeing Superman at a young age on VHS.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, ain't it?
Yeah, that's different. A migraine and Superman. So for me, it was at the theater. I was 11 years old, a new 11 years old, because I'd only been 11 for like a month and a half at that. No, I was 11 and 2 months old. Anyway, so 1978, December, I didn't see it the opening weekend, but I remember seeing the ads for it. And the ads used to always tout, "You will believe a man could fly." And I remember going to school the weekend after it came out. And I remember kids talking about it, and this girl said to me, "Have you seen the movie yet?" And I said, "No, I haven't seen it yet." And she said, "Well, it's really good. I think, you know what? You can really believe a man could fly. It's true. You will be able to believe it." Because we never really seen special effects like that before. I mean, we had Star Wars the year before and Close Encounters, and now this, but not where we're seeing somebody flying. We had the old Superman serials and the TV series, and this really looked believable. So I remember going to see it, and like you, John, the title sequence blew me away, which I've learned since that wasn't the original intent. That was used in the trailers, and they got such a great reaction from it, they decided to use that in the movie. And it affected me just as much as Star Wars did the year before. I became a huge Superman fan. I subscribed to every title that DC had Superman in, from DC Comics Presents to Action Comics to Justice League, whatever. I mean, if it was Superman, I was there. And I'm not as big of a fan, and I'm not into Superman like I was back then. But yeah, it was. I was as much into Superman then as I was Star Wars.
For me, I'm a little bit more like John, because when this movie came out, I wouldn't be born for another 7 months. And so when I discovered Superman, it was on VHS, and it was around the same time that I was discovering Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Star Trek, you know, all of these things I was discovering at the same time. And so Superman, which is kind of funny that, you know, four of those all have to do with John Williams. So maybe it has something to do with being, you know, linked together. But it was never a movie. I don't know if it ever had the same impact on me in this that it did on other people, in the sense like that it became my favorite movie or anything. But Superman is my favorite character in comic book lore. And he's all over my house, you know, like I'm wearing a Superman t-shirt now. Superman is just my favorite character. And there was something about him that I absolutely love. And so I do think that you could probably chart that all the way back to, there had to have been something about this movie. I don't remember what it was, honestly. I can't tell you. But something just stuck in my brain, Superman. And, you know, when I got into comics, you know, he was the character that I read first and then branched out. But it's always been Superman. Now, I mean, and then too, it was funny because, you know, I ended up growing up and like Batman, they made all these Batman movies, but they never made another Superman movie. And, you know, I don't know if part of that was that, you know, we'd all seen Superman 4 and we were like, oh, I don't know if I ever want to see another Superman movie again.
No, that definitely had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But I just mean in my mind, I think there's a part of like what I thought of is the those Superman films that kind of all got cobbled together with 1 through 4, because, you know, there's I think that's just part of it for me. And so it definitely left some kind of mark, because Superman himself, the character, became my favorite character. And I thought it was so interesting because when you look at the way that this movie was put together, it seems to start off like you got like Mario Puzo writing the script, you know, which, you know, done The Godfather. So that seems like a great start. But then when you really start to peel back all the layers, like, it's a mess. And I thought one of the most fascinating things is that they wanted Spielberg actually to direct the movie. And they decide to wait to see how his Big Fish movie opens. And by the time that they were going to ask him, because it is super successful, he's already going to do Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I was reading, too, that actually Guy Hamilton, the Bond director, had been hired for a while to direct this film. So it could have gone in some very interesting directions with either of those two people doing it than Richard Donner, which I think is fascinating that, you know, we have all this behind the scenes stuff that happens with this movie.
Well, I think that, you know, you touched on Puzo and sort of the script development and everything, and no small part of that, I definitely think, has to do with the intent of the Salkinds as producers. And previous to this, I think that definitely what Donner brought to the table that was very important for this film working, and I'm not saying anything original here. Like, seriously, I think by this point with Superman the movie, all of us are standing on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, like this is a movie that has been looked at time and again. But, you know, it is true that comic book properties were all very, you know, they're kids stuff. You know, and you look at the first forebear is Batman, and you know, the Adam West Batman, really. And so there's definitely more of what we see in Superman's 2 through 4 is much closer to what the Salkinds had in mind. And it was really, I think it's very key that Donner was the one directing, because he seems to have been the one to say, no, this is, you know, like that whole tagline, you'll believe a man can fly. This isn't a joke. You know, there are funny moments, there's humor of the time, there's all of that type of stuff, but Superman himself is not a joke. He's real. And they knew that they had to sell him for this to work. And I think Donner has a very large hand in that.
Yeah, they knew that he was American institution and treated him that way. Just as if you were making a movie about Abraham Lincoln. Now, yeah, it wouldn't be as funny at times in some humorous things, and this is totally different. But, I mean, this is a respectful character, one that people really idolized and looked as all-American. I mean, he's now an international character, but, you know, in his initial publication of comics, he was very much, you know, the American way, the American hero, and he was treated as such by Donner. And you're right, those next movies treated it more like a joke, not just Superman himself, but all the characters and the situations. And I don't even know if they were also looking at that as saying, well, we have to be a little campy or whatever because it's comics and we want to appeal to kids. And as a kid watching these movies, it was more of the more serious tone that appealed to me more than the campiness and comedy that came from the other movies.
I think it's really interesting because I think you can very much tell where where Donner has the strongest hand in the movie and where maybe his hand starts to slip from having as much control over what you get. Because I think, to me, the beginning of the movie has exactly what you guys are talking about, but as you get towards the end of the movie, I feel like that falls away and it becomes much more campy and kind of silly. And honestly, I would say that it becomes exactly what you guys are talking about. Like there's a much more camp feel to the film, especially with Lex and you know, Miss Tessmacher and, you know, Otis, their whole plan, the way it all comes together. I think, let me put it this way. The moment you get to Metropolis, to me, the entire movie shifts from being something that's kind of reverential and very, I think, wonderfully serious, but also just kind of like joyfully explorative of what it means to, like, you know, Superman coming into his powers and everything. And then you get to the Metropolis and the rest of the movie, and I think it definitely shifts in tone for me. And I think it's a tale of two movies.
I can't agree with that, because the thread through all of this is Superman himself. And while there's admittedly humor, I mean, it's almost like, even though the movie doesn't come out for some time from when this does, it's what I would call the Return of the Jedi principle. There's an escape valve with the Ewoks. There's a lighter element to that. But when you really look at what's going on, you know, there's a very, you know, serious thread through everything. Is Otis comic relief? Yeah, he absolutely is. But at the same time, it is a comedy. You know, it's an opportunity for comedy to entertain the audience. I mean, like, it's at no, like, I don't see this being campy. There's definitely humor, and Otis himself is, you know, a walking, you know, comic character and everything. But at the same time, I don't see Metropolis itself being campy, and I don't see, I mean, you know, the fact that they tap into, atomic weaponry, that's like a, you know, it's the middle of the Cold War. That's on everybody's mind. That's exactly what a supervillain would go try to do.
And I think the thing that, for me, that I, you know, even John Williams, when I was watching him talk about the music for Superman, he called the movie kind of theatrical camp, and I completely agree, especially by the time that you get to Metropolis. I think that the movie becomes quite campy, and part of that has to do with a lot of the things that happen, whether it's the flying sequence or whether it's just the way that the plan comes together for Lex and, you know, his buffoons. The way they pull it off is ridiculous and very campy. I do think that you are absolutely right, though. I do think that the Superman character himself is the one thing that is not campy throughout the film. I think that the way Chris Reeves plays him, and I think the fact that his through line, that is the thing that is not that way. And I think that's good, because without that, I think the movie would have been completely a camp routine. But it's not, because you have him who is earnestly taking the role and who he is and what he represents very seriously. He does it in a fun way, but I also think that there's a reverence there for the character and just the way it's played to bring him to life in a way that is not campy. I think a lot of the things around him, especially once you get to Metropolis, become that way. And it's the first half of the movie that I love the most, whereas it's the second half of the movie that's like it just goes off the rails for me.
So I'm kind of in between on this. I don't think of this movie as being campy. I think of 2, 3, and 4 as being campy movies. I do see there's some campy elements in this film, but I look at this film as being almost 3, maybe 4 different films, because when we're in Krypton, it's very sci-fi.
Oh, you mean Krypton.
Krypton.
We're on Krypton.
I'm yeah. sorry, Marla. Krypton. So when we're on Krypton, it's very much a science fiction movie. Next thing, all of a sudden, we have Kal-El come to Earth, and now it feels very Norman Rockwell. I mean, it's almost like, I mean, totally different from what we just saw on Krypton or Krypton. And then, you know, and then we kind of get back to a bit of that sci-fi element when he gives her the Fortress of Solitude. When we get to Metropolis, I don't have a problem with that. I actually love the first part of the whole Metropolis part of the movie, because at this part, all of a sudden, I didn't feel like it was campy, but it was just more of how it seems like the world, and of course in the city, everybody's kind of messed up. People have issues. I mean, we got this guy from the 50s who now all of a sudden ends up in the late 70s and things are screwed up. And I feel like we're finding humor in ourselves at that time and what society is like through the eyes of Clark, who seems to have his act together and is probably the smartest person in the room. It falls apart for me when we start to get to Lex and Otis and that whole missile thing. And that's when I start to actually even lose interest.
That's a different discussion. But what I want to absolutely be with you on is that there is, you could call it sort of the Fargo element. To Clark/Superman, the city is a strange, bizarre place. It really is country boy comes to the big city. And it's this big, overwhelming, noisy place, a metropolis, where everybody's nuts. Like, what, you know, what's going on? And of course, Metropolis is, you know, the background plates are New York, and, you know, and they're filming in New York and stuff like that. Metropolis was supposed to represent New York in the comics, and, you know, just as Gotham was. But like, there is, I definitely think, Bruce, you're spot on with that interpretation, where, you know, Clark is the grounded one and the world's gone nuts. Like, we're seeing that sort of juxtaposition of, you know, that the breadbasket upbringing into the city life.
Right. He's a fish out of water.
Yeah. Now, in terms...
that would be Aquaman.
Yes, right.
that's just next week, Bruce.
Yeah, this might lead to the next show.
Right? Yeah. But
no, I think the way you broke it down, though, Bruce, is perfect. And I think that it gives us a good time to kind of talk about the movie then in segments, because we kind of went all over the place there and kind of like, but just fine. I mean, it creates for, I mean, and we all have a different point of view, which I think is making this a great conversation. But let's kind of look at it in those segments that you broke it down in, because I think you're absolutely right in that, and to call that out. Even Donner, our good friend Sean Eastridge, I'm going to plug his podcast. He got a chance to interview Donner and over on Missing Frames, and they talked about this idea that there is this kind of segmented nature to the film, and that it specifically has even a different look and a different feel on purpose. And I think it was so interesting because when you're creating Krypton, Krypton is very different, even in its pronunciation by Marlon Brando, than it was ever depicted in the comics. And so everybody now thinks of Krypton as being this, you know, kind of like weird ice or like, you know, crystal planet. But this is something that they completely introduce in this film that had never been seen before in the comics, and yet now it has just a massive following, and we all kind of immediately think of the Fortress of Solitude, you know, as being this weird ice palace with crystals. What do you guys think of this? Because it is something that really only existed in the movies up to this point, and then even when John Byrne came in and redid Superman, his Man of Steel run, Krypton was very different there. It was much more like the Krypton that we kind of see portrayed in the show Krypton, in like the version of Man of Steel that Zack Snyder did pulls very heavily from that idea, a lot of the ideas there. And so I don't know, what do you guys think of this Krypton and its depiction? Because it doesn't, what's most interesting to me is it doesn't feel like a place that anybody would actually want to live. It feels like And it feels very 2001, which makes sense since that movie had just come out.
Well, And the director of photography is the same one, Jeffrey Unsworth. And
right.
With Krypton, what I think is beautiful about it, besides the absolutely magnificent set design and, you know, the reflective tape and camera tricks and all of those sorts of things that they do, is the fact that it gives this alien technology without, and this alien planet without some sort of hook for me to grab onto it and say, oh, well, that's not how something like that would work. That's not how this, like, it all looks like magic. And so as a result, there's nothing for me, regardless of what age I am. It, if anything, I would say that's the greatest strength of so much in this movie, is it is the way that our inner child likes to think until we drum it out of ourselves, if that ever tragically happens. But, like, you know, there's no reason a planet can't just be it's a bunch of crystals and hula hoops keep you in prison and, you know, big projected heads pronounce guilt. And it's, why? How does it work? Who cares? It just looks cool. Okay, sure. Works for me.
I agree, because when I watched the movie recently, I was thinking how it doesn't feel dated to me. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you would see futuristic settings in movies at that time, or even in the 80s, you know, you can watch the Battlestar Galactica from the 70s and it looks like it's from the 70s and such. And I mean, there's probably some to Krypton in this that looks maybe late 70s, but it does look very alien and different, that it didn't feel dated, like, oh, that looks like a 1970s look at the future or another planet. Because, like you're saying, Matt, about the comics, it's a different look than what you saw in the comics. And what right. is funny to me is my daughter, who is now 17, she's a big superhero movie, and she hadn't watched this movie since she was much younger. And so she watched it with me. And at the end, she says, wow, I really love that movie because it's so true to the comics. And she was commenting about not just Krypton, but the Fortress of Solitude and Superman's outfit and everything, his suit, you know, and how that's what is in the comics. And I didn't go on into it, but it's like, well, really, the movie started to inspire things in the comics. You know, she saw it after, because I remember in the 70s, yeah, Krypton looked actually more like a 1950s version of the future or another planet than what we saw in this. But it's funny, they have no furniture on Krypton, so I don't even know if Kryptonians can sit.
Apparently not. Well, could you sit in that, you know, outfit? You know,
I know.
I do agree with you guys. I think that you make a really good point in the sense that they create a sense of this place where you never ask yourself, how does that work? And that's a good thing. I do think that it's too austere, so that it doesn't make me feel anything when it's destroyed. I think that's the thing that I do think is missing from this section, where I feel like you want to feel like you're losing something other than just, you know, Jor-El, his wife, and you know, Clark's parents, you know, Kal-El's parents. I feel like you want to really miss Jor-El and Lara and the planet itself, like the we're losing something in the universe. And it doesn't really seem, this doesn't add that for me. But I do think, you know, when you look at the Silver Age comics, which a lot of this movie pulls from, even, I mean, Clark is specifically in a very, he is a Silver Age Superman, in that is exactly what the uniform looks like that he's wearing. And even a lot of, I would say, the rest of the movie maybe feels like that. But I think that they try to do something here, and I think it works mostly well. And I think part of that is just the establishing shot that they have as you come in on Krypton, you know, and the dome opens, and, you know, you've got the council there, and it creates, I don't know, the one thing they definitely do is they do not make this place feel welcoming. So
that's why I said furniture, because it really doesn't feel like a lived in universe.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, it contributes to the alien feel, like I mean, look, we've got a bunch of people walking around and somebody has an English S on their chest, you know, like, okay. Like the austerity of it, I think, very much is necessary to convey that extremely alien sort of concept. I mean, I guess I get what you're saying, but like the, you know, in terms of the emotional impact of it, no, I don't feel this great, tragic, you know, heart-wrenching moment when Krypton dies, but I come to understand the impact of its loss through the character of Superman later. And that, you know, so it becomes more important as everything advances, as it were.
What did you guys think of Marlon Brando as Jor-El?
I mean, it's fine. Yeah. I don't know.
I know there was some stat that he was the highest per word actor in film history when the final cut came out of this film. Now, they've since had revised cut and all of that stuff. But like when the film came out, like somebody did the math and it was something absolutely obscene what he was paid. But that's Brando. If you're asking, do I think he brought any, I don't know, what's a trendy word? Gravitas to the character? Sure. You know, Brando conveyed, an important, intelligent presence. Do I think that it had to be Marlon Brando, that only Marlon Brando could convey that? Probably not. But at the same time, he does a fine job. I believe in his Jor-El.
Yeah, it's not a performance that I would say, oh, you know, if you want to see Marlon Brando, go see Superman.
You know? Forget Streetcar Named Desire. Go see Superman.
Yeah. Yeah. Forget The Godfather. Yeah. You don't need any of those, you know.
It's good, but it's not. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole waterfront lot there for him to do. Yeah, there's just not a whole, and he can't sit down either. So, I mean, there's just not a whole lot for him in this movie to do. But yeah, I think it's a fine performance, but not, you know, not a breaking performance.
I said, just give me a chair. I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
The chairs were always just off camera. That's, there you go. There's your in-universe explanation.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, both of you, though. I think that he does the job adequately, and he does what the role needs him to do. And it's interesting too, you know, we didn't really talk about when they're putting this movie together, but the fact that they were shooting the movies together. And so they really are setting up the second movie at the very beginning of this movie, which is Zod.
Yes.
And so you have this whole, like it creates, this sense that there is this whole part of this movie that's happening that doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie, but it is going to be important for the second part of the movie. But the way that they do it, it just gives you a sense of who this Jor-El character is more than anything else. And so it works very well to open the film like that.
Yes, I completely agree. Completely agree.
Yes, and I love the crystals. Going back to kind of what John said, it's not like we're seeing some weird sci-fi device that, you know, or what. I mean, it's just, you know, all your data is held in a crystal. And I just think about nowadays where we have data that's just on a thumb drive, you know, and I just love the idea that, you know, an essence of a being that, you know, can project himself later to Clark, and all this information is all just held in crystals. To me, that I love that part. It never was anything that meant a whole lot to me before, but this time watching it, I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I've never been a huge fan of the crystalline technology because it just seems really, I don't know. It's never been my favorite thing in the Superman lore, is the crystalline technology. And what's weird is how the comics have kind of used both. They've used kind of the John Byrne look with the crystalline technology. So you have a combination. And I think to me that works a little bit better, mainly but just because it makes Kryptonian things feel slightly, like as we were talking about, homey. Like when you see in the comics Clark's Fortress of Solitude, it doesn't feel so austere and like you wouldn't want to live there, you know? Like, and that's the one thing I think that, by having Krypton feel so austere, it's like people don't actually live here. And I think that's the thing you need to, I would have loved to have more of. But it's such a small part of the movie that it doesn't matter. Like, you don't you can't spend more time there.
No, you should have just had a puppy. So. That would have helped.
A crystal puppy.
A crystal puppy, yes. Well, you know, like the Vulpix on The Last Jedi. So.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. There's your tie into the universes.
There you go.
There you go.
Superman exists in Star Wars, guys. Smallville, I think, is absolutely my favorite part of this movie. I think this is the part of the movie where everything Donner does with the character and everything Donner does with the time period, obviously being the 50s, I just feel like he nails everything he's going for, you know, with Ma and Pa Kent and Clark's struggles and him, you know, coming face to face with what is supposed to be the biggest lesson of his life up to that point, which is he can't save everyone when his father dies. Like, I think this whole section of the movie is really, really, really good. And actually, it is my favorite part of the film.
Yeah, I can't blame you. Smallville is special, but there's the final scene with Pa Kent and the funeral and everything. It's such an incredibly played scene. And Glenn Ford is just magnificent as Pa Kent. And there's so much about him that is believable and kind. Like, you can see this person producing the Clark Kent / Superman we get later in the movie. We can see Pa Kent's influence as basically a straight line. And I think that his death scene is played so beautifully. I can't make it through that scene without crying. Like, sometimes very, very much. Like, it's such an incredibly powerful and moving moment about, and, you know, just it's the way life happens. You know, you're going along, everything's great, and then, oh no, and you're done. And it's like, it has this just poetic simplicity to it. And having that be the driver that has, you know, Clark go out and find himself and figure out who he really is, I think is just it's such a magnificent point in the film. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I would also say that the Smallville section of this movie is my favorite and maybe even closely tied to the early parts of the Metropolis stuff. But, yeah, the death scene is always very emotional for me, but at the same time, I always have to laugh when I see the Cheerios box because it's such a big product placement in the way it's held and put on the table. But
hey, man, I still love Cheerios. I don't know what you're talking about.
I do. I know you do. You bought Cheerios when you were at my house.
That's true. I got you hooked on one of them.
Yes, you did. But also, to talk about another scene, when Clark is at the football field at school and he has to stack the shoulder pads and the helmets, and then he's talking to Lana, and then they knock things over, and, you know, basically he's getting picked on, and then they leave and he kicks the football and runs home. And the thing I like about that scene, and I think I really liked as a kid, is, you know, there were times that, you know, I had been picked on or things aren't going my way, and sometimes you just, you know, you're probably more than what you're projecting to people and they don't realize it. And you just want to kind of break out and be that Superman and say, look, there is more to me than you know. And that's why I always felt like I could relate to with Clark, that, you know, they don't know who he really is. And yet at the same time, he can't share that. And I always loved that scene, and I always loved the Clark character because of that. And that was one thing I liked about the Smallville series. I felt that the Smallville series did a really good job portraying Smallville in the best way that I'd seen since this movie. And believe me, because Superboy, that series in the late 80s, oh, no, that was silly. And I just recently bought the DVDs just to laugh at it.
Can't blame you.
It is really interesting because one of the things that I kind of struggled with in the movie watching it again was, you know, the lesson of kind of learning when Paul dies, you know, he says to Ma that all of these powers and I couldn't save him. And this lesson of learning that he can't save everyone. Like, there will be people he cannot save, and that has to be okay. One, because he can't be everywhere at once either, you know. But I struggled with that idea because then at the end of the movie, when he reverses time and he saves Lois, it kind of seems to be a slap in the face to that lesson, which is, no, I will use my powers to do something that's completely unnatural for this planet and save a woman I really just met, even though I'm madly in love with now. I was just watching and I was frustrated because it seems very contradictory, because it's such a wonderful message for Superman. Like, that is the most important message for Superman, right? Which is, I can't save everyone. So I need to find a way, even with all that I can do, to learn to be okay with that. Even his own father, right? Adopted father. And yet then at the end of the movie, he just kind of throws that away and does this thing that, I, you know, bothers me.
Well, the two things. One is that, he's spending time with her as Clark and Superman and everything. And the whirlwind romance is a staple of cinema and even life sometimes. Whirlwind romances happen. In terms of the ending, any, I guess, seeming incongruity with it probably stems from the fact that this wasn't what the ending was supposed to be in this one. Basically, they had to move quickly and they had to take the ending of 2 and move it forward to the ending of 1 so they could meet a release date that the Salkinds wanted. And like, it was all, you know, Donner had objections to it and everything like that. But, you know,
which makes sense because it, like you said, it kind of feels incongruous with,
well,
the rest of the film.
I mean, everybody understands that turning a planet backwards isn't going to reverse time, but well,
yes.
You know, all it's going to do is just make things worse, actually.
Oh, this is news to me. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry, Bruce.
Yeah, Bruce, if you turn the Earth back like that, actually, you're just going to create tidal waves that would probably kill just about everyone.
Well, I mean, never mind the fact they don't even address the asteroids and the Lagrange points that would plummet down and destroy the poles and therefore crack the planet in half. Or what's the influence on the moon, for Pete's sake? Does the moon keep traveling? Does the moon come back? Does the moon... But at the same time, and this is going to sound... like more of a dodge than it is. There's also a different sensibility, I guess, about this, in that while we all agree that at Donner's word, verisimilitude is what you have to make the audience believe, sell them on the truth of it. There's still that understanding that you're dealing with something that is a quote unquote comic book movie. You know, like I know that there's no Infinity Gauntlet, but I'll buy into it as long as you sell me on the rest of it, sort of thing. And I think that you can make definitely an allowance for him, moving the Earth to save Lois, because that goes just along with the whirlwind romance and the romantic arcs that, you know, that inspire, you know, this sort of story, you know, the knight saving the princess sort of thing, is that all bets are off when love is in the mix, sort of thing. So that's why I can, you know, be okay with and go along with it, is this big, fiery, passionate love that he has, that he's found, and that makes us do things that we that are more than we thought we could do, or that might not be the best call, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. And I agree. And just to add to that, there's, I think, at least 3 times we hear Brando say the line that, you know, you can't change history, or you shouldn't change history, something to that effect, which
right.
in a sense he's doing by rewinding time. So it goes against what Jor-El's telling him. It goes against, you know, human nature and what his adoptive father is always, you know, like, you know, you've got these powers, you have to protect them. And even though he couldn't save his adoptive father from dying, having these powers, he has certain restrictions. And yeah, because of love, he's willing to break those rules and those bonds and those restrictions for the love of a woman he met just 5 days ago.
I'm sorry. I just want to say, before we beat up too much on like the whole, he just met her 5 days ago. I always go back, first date with my wife. I walked out of the subway station. I called up a friend of mine and I said, I've met the woman I'm going to marry. I knew at that moment. It's struck by the thunderbolt. So it's fine by me.
And I'm not discounting that at all. I do think, I will say for me, that I don't feel like the movie does a great job, personally, for me, to justify the ending that they give us. But I also, I personally think it harms the character of Superman to make him do that just for Lois. Like, Lois is the one that he does that for instead of everybody else that was going to die. Like, you know.
But he'd already saved.
It makes Superman seem really kind of petty and selfish, if you ask me.
No, I agree with that.
But just because the one person that died, well, I'm going to reverse time and like damn the consequences, basically, of that, just for one person.
That doesn't bother me, but I agree with that. Yeah.
But at least he had gone around, and we saw him going around and like saving the kids on the school bus and repairing the San Andreas fault. And
but when he went back in time, he didn't save the school bus, so he had time to save Lois. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, and,
No.
Let's just get to that, because
seriously.
Okay, let's get to the ending, because I don't understand. We'll finish talking about the rest of it, because we're already there. I don't understand the ending. It doesn't make any sense. So he reverses time. Does that mean he has to go back and do everything he did before?
No.
He just goes faster this time?
No, he goes back. He goes back just far enough to get Lois and remove her before the crack opens.
Right. But what else? But my point is, all that other S still happens.
All the stuff happens. He saves everybody. Lois is the one person he can't save, right? So
right,
all bets go
part.
Off. He turns it back to just a moment before, because there's time between where he saves everybody else and repairs the fault and gets to Lois. And then he turns everything back, et cetera, but not so far back that the bomb hasn't gone off. He's all of that stuff.
What you're telling me is it's just bad editing.
Okay, you take it up with Stuart Baird.
Okay, I think I would, because it's bad editing, because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there is, but see,
I mean, it makes sense when you just explain it like that, but there needs to be then a shot that shows you what should have been done then is to show you him having fixed everything else and being able to, I mean, have the time to do that, because otherwise it just feels like he saved Lois and like, well, what the heck happened to everybody else?
What I will say is that there's nothing I could say beyond that to address your concerns, as it were. Except
no,
to say
no,
that
and
we,
what
we'd
you
already...
says is, said is completely logical and it makes sense. I just feel like the movie doesn't tell me that well enough.
No, I agree, because again, I agree, because when I watched this with my daughter, when it was done, that was one of the first things she said. She was saying the same thing you're saying, Matt. It's like, wait, how was he able to save, like, what happened with the other stuff? Did that even happen? Or what, you know, did he, you know, and I, then John, like you were saying the same thing. Like, I think he was doing all those other things, or he came right at that moment. I think it would have worked as you see him turning the planet around backwards. We're seeing quick shots of everything going backwards and the dam going back together and the missiles not striking or whatever. It would have been better, I think, once he had the world go back around again, maybe you show those again, but it's almost like in a fast forward type of motion, as if he's working quicker to repair the dam and throw the rocks down to stop the water and psh, takes off and boom, we get to Lois, almost in that same kind of play. But you know, just a little faster, because I like to believe that I don't know when he stopped the Earth, but I like to believe that maybe he went back, saved the school bus, did the dam, but he was moving faster because he knew where to go, and it gave him time to get to Lois and prevent the crack in the road.
I will also throw out that I highly doubt anybody in 1978, at least, was spending as much time thinking about the theoretical quantum mechanics of time travel that was going, except for probably that one, probably a young Neil deGrasse Tyson sitting in the audience saying, well, you know, it wouldn't really.
And well, then his, actually.
And then his lunch money was taken and he was very lonely walking home because he didn't even have enough money to get the bus afterwards.
Well, and also consider when Superman returns to save Lois, is there the other Superman that was there before?
See,
that's a good question. Yeah,
no,
that's so
what happens?
Question.
What happens is accidentally Kyle Reese is sent back to this is what triggers Skynet.
Yeah! Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So now
that's when that happens. Okay, that makes so much sense.
Krypton is right near Crate, and now Terminator is part of the Superman movie universe. Everything comes together.
I like
together.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you guys, okay, so we got that ending, that part of the ending down. What did you guys think about when he travels north, goes to the fortress, and kind of goes to, I guess, Kryptonian boarding school for 12 years to learn how to use his powers and, of course, you know, get this really snazzy suit, too?
It seems to go a little long, I think. Yeah, I mean, I like it because I like that the Fortress of Solitude looks like Krypton. I think it's kind of weird that he goes to basically the North Pole, but it's isolated, so that makes sense to me. I would have liked to seen that, you know, when he was in the Arctic, when he was breathing, you'd see his breath because it's cold, but it looked so much in studio, so it didn't seem all that real to me. But I liked him talking to Jor-El. I just felt like it just went on a little too long, but that's my opinion.
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I mean, in terms of the breath, like, unless you're going to do the John Carpenter, you know, turn the studio into a meat locker sort of thing. Like, seriously, yeah. with the thing, he turned the studio into a meat locker. And then, you know, with this, I can definitely see a production company saying, we're shooting here for like 2 days, guys. We're not doing that. Although, you know, in the modern age with like James Cameron putting breath on, you know, in Titanic, I think that was the first time that I can recall them doing
that. Digital breath?
Yeah, where they added the digital breath because they knew that people would be able to tell it wasn't cold or whatever. You know, I think that the Jor-El stuff, I can understand somebody saying, you know, it's a little long. I don't have that impression. I think that it's so fascinating with the, I guess, arguably three different cuts that they've released. That TV cut was never meant to be that's not like an officially say like that was ad revenue cut basically. But I always found it so much fun that there was enough footage of Brando that they could then use him and reconstruct him for Superman Returns. And it was all stuff we hadn't seen before, but had been shot in 1978, which I thought was just wonderful. But yeah, you know, make Brando earn the paycheck. Have him on screen as long as you can, you know?
I think the thing that it does is what you were talking about earlier, Bruce, is that this kind of explains why you stunts Clark's development in the sense of, like, he's stuck being somebody who feels like he came out of the 1950s. So when he arrives in the 70s, he feels like that person out of time because he has been out of time, literally. He's been on this, you know, esoteric journey with his father, you know, his Kryptonian father, learning all of these things and learning how to hone his powers, how to use his powers and everything. I think, you know, it's a good way to make that happen. So you do have a character who comes back and says the word swell when nobody said swell in like, you know, 20 years. It makes a lot of sense. And I think it's internally consistent. It's a great idea. And it's the thing that I think is really interesting because, say, when you pull that idea out of something like Man of Steel, where he doesn't have that, you get a different character, you know? So I think this was a good thing to add in here to legitimize who Clark is when he gets to Metropolis, which is somebody who's not like everybody else. He really does feel like, you know, a relic of the past when it comes to his behavior, how he treats people, all of those things. And like you said earlier, Bruce, which I thought was really smart, it's that thing that's where they're commenting then on maybe what we've lost in that time period through Superman by somebody who just treats people with decency and respect and all those things that were slowly slipping away even then.
Well, and the thing is, you have to acknowledge that that sort of thing also plays along with, you know, the 70s was all about 50s nostalgia, and the 80s was all about 60s nostalgia, and the 90s was all about 70s nostalgia. Like it's that sort of looking back thing. You know, Happy Days is a 70s show, and you know, Grease and stuff like that. There's a look back toward the 50s, but Superman, of those works mentioned, isn't making fun of the values of that time period so much as, you know, to your point, Matt, talking about how, oh, well, the world's changed. And it sort of says, yeah, but, you know, Clark is a pretty great guy. Did we change too much? Is there something we need to recapture from that time period that's, you know, good and pure and wholesome? And especially you look at, you know, you look at New York, the, you know, the cultural center, you know, of the country, especially in the, you know, looked at in the 1970s as such, and you look at what was going on there, I could completely understand people looking back and be like, maybe yeah, we're a little too far gone here, guys. Need to, you know, Studio 54 is a little much, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but I think it's a factor of time, but it's also a factor of place, because it also is a difference between coming from a small town out somewhere, sure, in the Great Plains or the Midwest and going to the Northeast metropolis big city. I mean, this could have easily worked just as well if Clark grew up on a farm in the 70s and, sure, then immediately leaves Smallville and ends up in metropolis, and we would have probably the same kind of play in this, you know?
Yeah. Oh, sure. The culture shock would be, you know, just as pronounced. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Getting to Metropolis, and this is the part where we get, you know, the big reveal of Superman and, you know, Chris Reeve getting to play the duality of Clark versus Superman. I think that getting a chance to watch the film again, I think he does a very good job playing the role. And what's interesting is that there's something about the way he plays Superman, where there's a genuineness to him, but there's also a bit of snark to Superman, which is kind of fun. Like, and it's not like super mean snark, but it's like there's a slight bit of snarkiness to him every once in a while, and it's just it's good. I think he does a very good job of playing the different roles. I mean, even in, you know, when he's in Lois's apartment and he takes off his glasses and he straightens up, you know, you get that visual representation of how much he's affected his posture, mm-hmm, and the way that he's played the character. And I think if anything works in this movie, it's Christopher Reeve playing Superman. I think he brings an effortlessness to playing this role, which I think is fascinating. Because it's not an easy thing to do, especially with all he was required to do athletically, with trying to do the flying scenes and all that stuff. It would have been exhausting. I also thought it was really funny how he tells Lois that he always tells the truth while he's telling everyone the biggest lie, which I thought was kind of funny because, yeah, you know, he's lying to everybody that he's not Clark Kent. So it's like he's the world's biggest liar who always tells the truth.
Yeah. Landru would explode.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
So, yeah. Hey, wait a minute. There you go. Landru, Superman is Clark Kent. Superman always tells the truth. Superman never tells anybody that he's Clark Kent. Does not compute. Boom. Done.
But what did you guys, I mean, getting a chance to kind of go back and watch this again, was there anything that stuck out to you just about the performance that Reeve gives?
I think, you know, you're right. The authenticity. At no point, at any point, while I'm watching this, regardless of what age I've come back and revisited it or anything like that, I have never questioned his performance. I've never said, oh, that's Christopher Reeve playing. He's Superman. Done. Sold. finished. That is it. And I think that's, you know, it's an amazing testament. It's an absolutely wonderful performance. And I, you know, as much as I agree with the word effortless, he does make it look effortless, but he makes it look effortless because he was just so talented. He was such a great talent. And, you know, you just have to look at some of his other work to know, you know, what tremendous skill he had that made it possible for him to sell this to everybody from age, you know, 6 to 100, even younger than 6. Every kid all the way up to the oldest adult believed Christopher Reeve was Superman, period.
Absolutely. I would also think that it's amazing how a man with that build and height can play Clark, but yet still make him feel small. I mean, that meek way of playing Clark and slouching and touching the glasses and such. I mean, if you really look at the other characters around him, you would think those characters would look up at him and say, gosh, this guy's a big, you know, tough looking guy because he's so tall and he's really well built. But just the way his body movement works, it makes the character look meek, even on screen. He looks small compared to the other characters. I don't mean just in character, he looks meek and small compared to the others. And then to be Superman, it's just amazing how he can make that transfer. And I love that scene in Lois's apartment where he makes the decision that he's going to tell her he's Superman, and you see that transformation, and then he decides not to, puts the glasses back on, starts to slouch down, and he seems small and meek again. And he is. I'm 100% sold that he's Superman, and I'm 100% sold that he's Clark Kent. So he's fabulous in that role, and I have yet to see anybody else play Superman that meets that kind of performance.
I will say there is, if there was anything I would have wanted to see, I would have liked to see it, the bumbling part turned down just a smidge, but that's just me personally. I think it's a little bit over the top, and that's the only part of what I get from Chris Reeve where I feel like there's almost a campiness to it, but he's always able to pull it back. So if I could do anything to change anything about what he did, which is very minor, would just be to have him tone that down by one notch, you know, like that's it. Otherwise, I think what he does is really good. I want to ask you guys, though, about Margot Kidder, because for me, this is the part of the movie that gets really difficult because I do not like her at all in this role. And it makes it really difficult for me to buy the movie because what Chris Reeve is doing, she's not for me. And she's one of the things that helps make this super, in my words, campy.
It's going to get tiring for me to sort of like defend, you know, these different points. I can see the point of view. I really can. But at the same time, I think that the sort of tragic reality of Margot Kidder's performance is it is so good that you forget that she's like her Lois inhabits the space, regardless of whether you agree with the interpretation of the character. She inhabits that space. She is Lois Lane. She's this Lois Lane. And so I think that Margot Kidder delivers a great performance in terms of the you know the campiness or the humor. I would love it if she were still around to continue speaking about the role. And I know that she had her difficulties personally that led to different unfortunate headlines and stuff like that. And she's no longer with us. But I really do think that. Of all of the actors below or above the line, I think that Margot Kidder is the one that over time has gotten a little bit of short shrift And I think it's because her character is very much a reflection of the modern woman of then, or a play on it, a riff on it. And so I think that sometimes those sensibilities don't age as well as some of the other character interpretations.
So I really do love her in this role, and I love it. I love her performance even more because I've seen some of the audition tapes with other actresses. And the one thing that stood out to me about her performance versus the others that auditioned was she had more spunkiness to her and more spice. And I really like that play when you have the meek Clark Kent next to this woman. They're like yin and yang. And then when he's Superman, she knows how to tone that down and become more of the meek character in that scene. And Superman is the more dominant character, and she's more of the fumbling, I don't really know what to do or what to say or whatever. And I think she does a good job bridging those two performances based on who she's playing against, whether it's Clark or Superman. But the thing I want to point out on what your concern is, Matt, and what you said about sometimes Clark seemed to that performance bumbling and fumbling a little too much. I think when we get to Metropolis, what I like about this, and I think their intention was doing, is it's not so much that it's campy. It's more that this, when we get to Metropolis, it's more of a wink to the audience throughout. There are so many out of universe jokes about, you know, oh, there's the phone booth. Well, it's not a phone booth. It's a phone stand. And so Clark can't go and change in the phone booth.
Yeah.
And, you know, Perry White always saying in the 1950s series, you know, don't call me Chief. And now all of a sudden, don't call me Sugar. Chief. Yeah. There are so many winks at the audience. And I feel that the performance of Clark and just pushing it to the edge of being a fumbling, bumbling guy that can't get his act together is still one of those winks to the audience that that's what you kind of expect Clark to be. And I feel like Lois does the same thing. It's like the performances maybe just a slightly bit over the top because the script calls for that. And it's that whole direction of you guys, the audience, are kind of in on this, and you know these characters, you get the inside jokes, and we're playing along with it. That's how I interpret it when I watch the Metropolis scenes.
I like what you say, though, Bruce, about how well Kidder transitions just as much as Reeve, where when the characters flip, you know, like when it's Superman, she's one way. When it's Clark, she's herself, and how they're both sort of, I guess, thrown off their game when they're not them really, you know, comfortable. And I like that. I really like that comment on the duality of it. I like that.
No, I see what you're saying, Bruce. And I think, you know, for me, again, you know, with the Superman stuff and with Chris Reeve, you know, the phone booth thing I thought was really funny. You know, that's just a great, you know, joke because there aren't, you know, a lot of phone booths anymore. So I thought that was excellent kind of humor to put in there.
Today he would walk up to a charging station for cell phones and look at it.
Yeah. You know, part of the thing with the Kidder is that they put that stupid flying sequence in where she's singing and it's just awful. That doesn't help the portrayal of the character, I don't think. So maybe if you'd taken that
Wait
out,
a minute.
It might have helped.
Stupid flying sequence?
I like the flying sequence. I don't like this whole montage of her like singing while they're flying. It's really bad.
Well, she's not singing. She's
okay.
It's her thoughts.
Like this whole like can you read my mind thing. It's just it should never have been in the film. Just allow them to fly and you know.
Well, I think that goes back to what John was saying. I think for the time it worked, but yeah, if they were to do that today in a movie, that would be really weird.
But at the same time, if even if you have a problem with it, the trade-off is that you get an absolutely beautiful piece of music composed by John Williams. Fair trade, so far as I'm concerned.
But then you ruin it by putting Margot Kidder doing this weird spoken word thing.
Well, what we really need to do is we need to point out that how is he extending his powers? I want to know. I want a scientific explanation.
I do
want to
know that. Because it doesn't make any sense. How is she flying like that? It doesn't make sense.
It's just crazy. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I just, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't, that's one of the things that doesn't work for me. I do really like Gene Hackman as Lex, although I don't think he gets a ton to do in the movie. He kind of, we'll put it this way, like, it's definitely one of those things where this is a time period where we don't really explain a lot of stuff. We just, like, put it on screen and, like, there's not a lot to Hackman's character as Lex. A lot of it's taken for granted, and a lot of things are, I mean, the fact that I don't understand how Hackman figures out the kryptonite thing, because it doesn't make any sense to me. The fact that you know, he easily figures out that, oh well, irradiated pieces of, you know, Superman's planet, that's what's gonna do it. You know,
it's like a book.
Yeah, it just, it like comes out of nowhere, and it's just because, well, we need Lex to know about kryptonite. But it's like, it's just so strange to me, because when I take into the context of the story, I mean, like, Superman's been on the job for like 5 days, like, you know, you're putting some things in from the source material that we all know metatextually, but inside the film don't necessarily make good sense.
Yeah, but a parsec is a light year, not a measure, you know, not a minute. And like, it's again one of those things where he's super genius and he figured it out. Okay. I mean, like, I think that the standards have just shifted in such a way that there's an expectation now that we're going to know how Thor's hammer was forged and those sorts of, you know, those sorts of things. And it's, you know, I don't have a problem with it at all. I mean, it's, for as much about the verisimilitude that we talk about and the selling it and those sorts of things and the move away from camp and the taking the character seriously, it's just fun to indulge the villain and the villain aspect, right? I mean, it's just fun. And Hackman is so much, he is having such a good time with this role.
No, I agree with that.
I mean, the biggest complaint I've ever heard up to this point is that he refused to shave his head. But, you know, they wrote in something that worked for it, so that's fine.
And I mean, I'm not complaining about that. I think the one thing that you kind of pointed out there is they're having, you know, I feel like with this, the character of Superman, we take him very seriously. But I don't feel like we take everything else in the movie very seriously, especially when we get to Metropolis and the Lex part and his plan. That's the part where it's like, we need that to be less campy, especially with Otis and Miss Tessmacher. And I feel like I want that to be a little bit more serious, because I'm having trouble. I think it's just a tonal issue. Like, there's the tone is not consistent enough when we get to Metropolis. With and I kind of wonder if part of that is because Donner is slowly losing control by this point of the edit, and he doesn't get to necessarily do all the things. I mean, they're already changing the ending anyway to something else. I just wonder if part of that comes out too in this part of the movie, because the other two parts of the movie I feel like are very consistent in the way that they take themselves seriously. So Metropolis just doesn't, and everything that happens after that, it's just not as serious, and I think it kind of hurts the movie.
I see the Otis and Miss Tessmacher thing, like, it's sort of the, you know, the super genius surrounds himself with those who can never challenge him sort of thing. And I don't know how seriously you want to take things when you're talking about setting off nukes. And I think that his plan is, yeah, you know what? I'll use the word comic. It's comic genius that he's going to sink California so that he can have oceanfront real estate to sell. It's one of those things where that, like, you know, like talking about the winks earlier, it's like, how are you possibly going to have some sort of plot that's going to require Superman's full efforts to stop, you know, like the only place they could go from here is to have other Kryptonites, you know, come back suddenly and fight him. Like, you're talking about a nearly all-powerful character. And so you've got to indulge that and be like, well, what insane plot could we throw out there that's going to be the big test of his powers for this big entertaining spectacle that we're trying to do? And this, you know, this fits that bill.
You know, I'm thinking about this period of time in the 70s, and the last really live action success that we had in a superhero was the 60s Batman series, which is very yep. campy. And I think a lot of the attitudes then were comic books are campy and silly and such. And I think as we're talking through this, when we are on Krypton and when we're in Smallville, there's a seriousness to this. Everything else plays a little more on the comic side, except for Superman. Yet Superman is probably the most ridiculous character in the whole movie.
Yes.
Because everybody else is a real human like we are, and then there's this guy that's got powers and can do X-ray vision and fly around in underwear. But he's the most real and most serious character in the movie. And I think the only way that works is you make a somewhat comic book, slightly campy movie, but create a seriousness and a credibility in the lead character by creating those earlier scenes that are more serious. So when we get to the Metropolis, all of a sudden we believe in this character and we are taking him seriously. And I think that's the brilliance of this movie. And I think that camp is part of comics and the attitude towards superheroes at that time. And I think that's why this movie works well. I don't think it would have worked as well if you didn't have some camp in the Metropolis scenes.
And I think there's also something that just as audiences we've gotten away from is there's just an acknowledgement we're here to have a good time. We're not here to incrementally move a 10-year plot forward. We're not here to necessarily tie together, you know, four different titles in a giant franchise or anything like that. We're here to experience and enjoy and delight and not worry about the real world for 2.5 hours. And so I think there's also that also informs a lot of what happens here.
And I think the movie works in the same manner as The Wizard of Oz. When you're in Kansas, ooh, that's where things are more serious and real and normal. And then all of a sudden you get to Oz and it's, you know, crazy. And we've got munchkins and witches and flying monkeys and whatever. I feel like it's that same kind of transition, almost like Metropolis is the fantasy world.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that makes sense. And I guess we're not in Kansas anymore. I think that's a good explanation. I think that's the thing that doesn't work for me. I don't think they needed to do that. And I have a very difficult time at the end of the film because they make that choice. The other part about the ending that really bothers me is just the timeline and the editing is really off because Lex and his cronies switch the missiles, but then they're back at the base to talk to Superman when he arrives, and then the missiles get shot off, and it literally takes them forever to get where they're going, enough time for Superman to languish in a pool. Like, it's all happening at the same time, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, the timeline for it all. It just bothered me in the editing because all of these things take place very quickly, and none of them make sense together.
I that stood out to me more so this viewing than it had in the past. There were some things about it that, yeah. And this has always been the least favorite part of the film for me anyway. But I remember watching it this round and Miss Tessmacher is saying, you know, save my my mother, she lives in Hackensack, you know, make that the first missile. Well, we've seen that missile going through like farm country, you know, all the agriculture going on. And then when he goes to get the missile, it looks like it's in Nevada somewhere, you know, it's like in desert area. It's like, wait, it looks like it already was going through the Midwest and heading towards New Jersey. And now it looks like it's in Nevada. Like even that like threw me off. It's like, wait, it just seems like they're just putting missiles wherever they want to put them.
Well, just never mind the fact that missiles actually shoot up into orbit and then, you know, they launch their warhead down. So there's really more of a parabolic arc than traveling over the countryside, as it were, which is why the, you know, SDI was proposed to shoot down the missiles and everything. But, you know, I like at that point, yeah, could I say, oh, well, this should happen in quicker sequence? Yeah, probably. But at the same time, it happens in a logical sequence, and I understand everything that's going on. So I'm not gonna fall on the side of calling it bad editing. I'm just gonna say, well, you know, all right, this took a little bit longer than it should have, or that I would have liked it to. But yeah, it's not a big sin.
What did you? I know. It's kind of hard when you know, John, you and I in Aggressive Negotiations, we just talked about the Return of the Jedi soundtrack. And, you know, they're just as much for the Star Wars series or the Indiana Jones series or the Harry Potter series. John Williams did something here that he did with those series, which is to create a audio language for this character so that when you think Superman, usually you think of the John Williams theme, which is just an incredible achievement that you can take notes and indelibly mark them on a character forever like that.
Yeah, I mean, the Superman score is, so far as I'm concerned, it gives anything he did for Star Wars a run for its money, and you know how much I love that music. The fanfare version of the Superman theme can move me to tears on certain days. This is an absolute masterwork of a score. It is always going to be mind-boggling what John Williams created from like 1975 to 1984 is like, wow, this is one brain. Now, the fun thing is that once, I don't think that listening to scores was really like so much of a thing before John Williams, but what's fun also is hearing sometimes little tiny cues that you could listen to and be like, oh, that sounds like when Luke is there in Return of the Jedi, or that you can hear in Return of the Jedi, you're like, oh, that sounds like the Green Crystal theme from Superman and stuff like that. And I think this is an absolute stunner of a score. I think it's just untouchable. I think it's magnificent.
You know what I like about doing these shows is like talking to you guys and other people and stuff, because it's like, I don't know that many people in my life, in my real life, personal life, that, you know, loves these movies and things like I do. And it's so great to hear you guys, even though some opinions differ than others, but, you know, there's things you guys say that I think, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't know if I was the only one who thought that, but obviously I'm not. You guys bring out the same things. And John, I, you know, when you said moves you to tears, I wasn't even sure if I was going to bring it up, but there's times where I've heard live performances of this. And one time, even in high school, we played this in band and I had to struggle from not getting teary eyed because I love the fanfare. It's my favorite, more so than Star Wars or any other piece of music. It's always been my favorite to the point that I've even thought of putting in my will to play this at my funeral because it's my favorite. But I don't want people to think, you know, why is he wanted this? Like, wait, think he's Superman? That's why he wanted to play this funeral? It's just, I love this piece of music. And when I hear the fanfare for Indiana Jones, that structure is very similar. They're almost too close. But, yeah, I mean, I think the music's brilliant. I love John Williams, and I love the score.
I loved, I was watching a behind-the-scenes extra, and Donner was talking about the score and how he loved it because, you know, it comes on the screen and it actually says, he's like, it says the word Superman to you.
Yeah.
Superman. Da, 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 da. I mean, it's like it legitimately is saying who the hero is, and it announces to you that this movie is all about Superman. And, you know, I think, like you said, John, it, and as we've talked through the John Williams scores for Star Wars, you know, we've done all of the original films now, we've done all of the prequel films. Williams just has a way of not only doing amazing fanfares, but it's all of that quiet music. It's all of those tender moments that Williams is able to do just so well. And, you know, I've listened to this score many, many times, and I have the 2-disc edition, which is just gorgeous presentation of the score. All the way from Krypton to the end of the film, it's a masterpiece. And I think, you know, Bruce, you're 100% right. And John, I think you said too, this rivals anything else that John Williams ever did. And it's so hard, it boggles the mind to think that he's responsible for all of the themes that play in my head a majority of the day, most days of the year.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, look, we're not adding anything special here to anything that's been said about the music, but it is the thing that I think, on top of the Smallville sequence, this is the thing I enjoy the most about the movie Superman, was the music. Like, it's the thing that I'm so glad this movie existed, because it meant that John Williams created what he did. And it's what makes this movie a hallmark to me, you know, is really that music, which is in a crazy thing to say, that the thing you love the most about a movie is the music. But John Williams is just that good. So,
yeah, I just to sort of like one last comment to tie into that is, this is just yet another score where, I mean, obviously I can't think up, you know, music for another movie. So this is sort of a silly comment, but when you hear it, And it's on the film, you just think to yourself, there's absolutely no other sound that could have happened for this. There's no other orchestration. Mm-hmm. There's no other arrangement of notes that works. Now, obviously, some other composer could have come in and done a fine job, but I cannot imagine, I can't fathom anybody else doing this. It's just magnificent.
So, Matt, I have to ask you, when the love theme comes on, do you start singing in your mind, "Can you read my mind?"
You're ruining it, Bruce. you're just ruining it.
I do, you know, Bruce.
John, it's so funny that you mentioned that, because one of the things that I love about those expanded scores for either Star Wars or, you know, they just did an expanded score section for all of his music for the Harry Potter films 1 through 3 that he did, which is phenomenal. But on the Superman soundtrack that I have, there are alternate takes.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, like you were talking about, you know, somebody else doing it. Well, John Williams did that himself, and he had to come to just the right notes. And it's always fascinating to listen to those alternate takes, because it's like, it's almost there, but it's not quite yet, you know, not quite. And he would it seems like Williams is, that's the thing that he's so good at, is realizing when it's almost there, but it's not perfect yet. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think differentiates him sometimes from maybe other film composers. And so, when you know, Zimmer had to try and create a new sound for Superman, like, you're like, well, good luck, bro. I mean, you know, and his is fantastic, but I mean, it's like, I just feel bad for somebody trying to do that. Like, it's an impossible task.
Well, I know this is a rabbit hole, but Zimmer was the right choice there, because Zimmer's all about minimalism and sort of like, mm-hmm, playing against, like, you look at his Batman work, you know, right, like it's a complete opposite in a sense from what Danny Elfman gives you. So it, right, made perfect sense for him to be the one to follow up with Superman, because it's like,
right,
you need the antithesis of what came before. That's the only answer you have to that question.
Well, and what's, you know, just to kind of go down that rabbit hole just a little bit, you know, what he's able to do is to create something that's soaring and beautiful and majestic, but in a different way.
Right.
And, you know, like you said, I think he was the perfect person, because he creates something, he can create amazing themes, but they're just different from the way that Williams does it. And that's a good thing. So gosh, I think, you know, it's one of those films of 40 years of Superman as we talk about this here. If you're going to try and rate this movie, what do you rate Superman the movie?
I think for any minor complaints I might have here or there, you know, like I conceded, like, you know, one sequence could go a little bit shorter than it does, that sort of thing. This is definitely, whole is greater than the sum of its parts. If you were to like sort of like pick it, no chairs on Krypton sort of thing. I mean, for me, this is knock it out of it, out of the park. There's a reason this has been regarded as a gold standard for so long. And I think that this is just, it's impossible to say something like there are no superhero movies as we know them without this. But honestly, this was such a genre defining moment that if you truly look at the way they, all the way down to the way they marketed the 1989 Batman 10 years later, it's almost identical to how they approached it. Big name celeb for the villain, zany comic booky plot at the end, character, main character taken very, very seriously, and the hype leading up to it was all about making you believe that this is real. And I think that there's a reason that this is looked back at so fondly and why people continue to enjoy it to this day. I think that this is an enduring classic.
Man, I don't know if I can say it any better than that. Yeah, I mean, to me, this is the ultimate superhero movie. Any superhero movie I saw after this, there were some that I really liked and some that I didn't, but none of them measured up to this. It really wasn't until I saw Spider-Man 2 that I really put that up there with Superman the movie, and then The Dark Knight. Then that put up, you know, then I started to see some superhero movies that I would put up there with this one. But yeah, this was the one that, this is the crown jewel. This is the level you want to get at. And yeah, so I mean, again, as much of a Star Wars fan that I am, this was up there for me at that time. And it's still, seeing it again this past week means a lot to me that, you know, I'd give it 5 out of 5 reverse trips around the world.
Well, thanks for screwing up the everything, Bruce, then. Gosh, because the moon's all out of whack. Anyway.
Yeah.
I am uniquely odd in that this film does not rank highly for me. There's too much about it that I have a problem with, and what I appreciate about it is that I do think that Donner is the first one to take the hero of a superhero movie and take it seriously. For that, I'm very grateful, because I do think that superheroes can be done well, and he starts a trend that continues to this day. I mean, I think there's a direct line from getting from Donner to, you know, Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises, Man of Steel, all those kind of things like that. He creates that line. The movie itself doesn't work as well for me personally, and that's just who I am. It doesn't. But I think that Reeve does a good job as the title character. I think the way that he plays the character is done well. You know, and it's interesting to me, because there are some choices there that other people that play him will actually use and stuff, you know. So, and I love the music, as I said. So for me, this is, you know, I'm unique in the sense that this is I don't think this is the pinnacle of superhero movies. I don't think super highly of it, for many of the reasons articulated earlier, and it's a 3 out of 5 for me. But for its place in superhero films and what it does and what it allows us to get to, I'll be eternally grateful for that.
Just as a side note, because you mentioned Batman, you know, we don't get Batman Begins. I'm sure you were alluding to this, but Nolan specifically called out Donner's Superman as his model for how to approach the hero. And actually, I know that there's an interview where like Nolan interviews Donner about it. And so you're so spot on that this movie had a very large hand in the most popular interpretation of Batman on screen and how he was portrayed.
Well, and I mean, Patty Jenkins said the same thing when she made Wonder Woman, you know, and I think for the way, again, that the movie itself, Superman, treats its title character, Superman, I think treating them with respect and treating them seriously is the thing that the movie does the best. And so, again, I think it's the reason that we get all that we've got now in this golden age of superhero films. You know, I put it this way. For me, Superman the movie is a Silver Age superhero film. Whereas I think where we are now is it's weird. It's not even the golden age. It is the age of the superhero film, and where we've come to is what I really enjoy. And to put it into comic terms, it is the Silver Age Superman that we've got now. For me personally, I'm much more a fan of the more modern comic book hero take on the character. So
I became a Superman fan because of this movie. Prior to this, I used to watch Super Friends every Saturday, but I didn't really become a Superman fan till this movie, as I mentioned earlier. But Matt, knowing that you're a Superman fan, what was it that got you into Superman? Was it the comics, or was it the animated series, or what was it?
I mean, I watched the animated series, so the Batman animated series and the Superman, which was good. I think more than the movie, it was I started reading the comics. And I got into the comics, you know. I read The Death of Superman, you know. I read a lot of the popular runs in more of the modern era. I've read everything from the New 52 all the way to what exists now. So I've been reading comics, I guess, for the last 10 years, you know. So I over 10 years now, I think. Well, that's ridiculous to think that I've been reading them that long, continuously. So I've been that whole modern era of Superman. And then I've gone back and read things like, popular runs like Birthright and Red Sun and all that stuff. So really it was the comics that made me a Superman fan. And then, you know, I mean, everybody who's listened to this show knows it was Man of Steel that really brought the Superman that I personally love to screen. So, it's interesting, I think, for me, just because, yeah, it was the comics. So, but guys, I really appreciate this. This has been so much fun. And I love that we all had different opinions. So hopefully you enjoyed listening to all of them. You can yell at me on social media. That's what it's for. But before you do that, I want to thank Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Ryan Millett, and Daniel Noah for supporting the show here through Patreon. They're my associate producers here on the show. Patreon is the way that you can support the network each and every week to make sure that all of the shows we do keep coming to you. It's an expensive enterprise to put this all together. So patreon.com/trekfm is where you can become part of our team. We have some great contribution levels, but honestly, every little bit helps. Again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Bruce, I've loved having you back. We were talking even before the show. It's like, man, I haven't seen you in a while. Like, we talk all the time behind the scenes, but we haven't been on the show recently together. And so it's great to have you back, and let everybody know where they can catch up with you and what else you've got going on.
Well, thanks for having me, and especially on this topic. And one reason you haven't seen much of me is because I've been busy doing literary treks here on the network with Dan Gunther, our Star Trek books and comics show. And I also do Live from the Edge with Brandi Jackalev. It is our live show usually the night after a new episode of Discovery comes on. We're live on YouTube, and then it's released as a podcast. During Short Treks, we try to do it the night of. And I also do the Star Wars Report, talking about Star Wars. And you can find me doing that with Riley Blanton and Mark Herleman. And of course, I'm always in the Babel Conference.
And John, it is absolutely a pleasure to have you back here in the 602 Club. Where can people find you? Because I'm sure that there are going to be many people who loved what you had to say. They absolutely love this movie, and they're going to want to contact you and let you know how much they loved you.
Oh, well, gosh. wouldn't it be nice if people showed up without pitchforks? Well, you can find me online as Kessel Junkie, KesselJunkie. That's on, I'm usually lurking around on Twitter, Letterboxd, Goodreads, and, you know, out there with my pal Craig, co-hosting Words with Nerds. I'm rarely in the Babel conference, so if you want me to see something there, please tag me. And, you know, there's a little show I do over on the Nerd Party Network. It's a Star Wars show, of all things, called Aggressive Negotiations that I co-host with you, Matt Rushing.
And we don't always agree there either. So, you know, if you enjoyed this conversation, sometimes, you know, we have lively, aggressive negotiations with each other about certain Star Wars topics.
You mean John's always right on that show, too?
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you. Somebody said it. Thank you.
You know, it's my own show, and I get no respect. You know, I'm like Rodney Dangerfield on my own show. Well, you can find me, especially if you probably do want to yell at me because I said something stupid on the show. Matt Rushing 02. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and Letterboxd, all under that name. You can find me here on the network. When we get a chance to record, Chris Jones and I do a show called The Orb about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. On the Nerd Party Network, I do one more show, and that's called Outpost, and I do that with Drea Kaufman. We talk about each and every chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then last but not least, I do a delightful little show with my good friend Courtney, where we talk about films through the lens of faith, and that is called Cinema Stories. But I want to say thank you so much for joining us, and up, up, and away! Thank you.